From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Today we'll speak with the author of The Allure of Immortality. It's a recently published book profiling the Koreshans, a now extinct celibate communal group that settled in southwest Florida. They believed we live inside a hollow earth. The book follows the Koreshans from their start in Chicago to their eventual settlement in Estero. Plus, hordes of the Walking Dead will once again converge on downtown Fort Myers for the 9th annual ZombieCon. We'll take a look at the event, which continues to grow each year. We'll also explore the rich history and subtext of the zombie genre and why zombies remain such a cultural phenomenon. That's ahead. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Jessica Mazaros. Thousands of people will be dressing up with gory makeup and costumes for the 9th annual Fort Myers ZombieCon this weekend. We'll take a closer look at the event, which attracts more and more people each year. We'll also explore our cultural fascination with zombies and the genre's rich history and subtext. WGCU's John Davis has that conversation later this hour. But first, we explore Lynn Milner's recently published book, The Allure of Immortality, an American cult, a Florida swamp, and a renegade prophet. The book historically profiles Koreshan worshippers from the late 1800s to their influence even today. It reads almost like a novel, though. Koreshans were celibate and believed marriage was a form of slavery toward women. The communal group shared workloads, food, and childcare. They also worshipped their prophet, Cyrus Teede. Milner is an associate professor of journalism at Florida Gulf Coast University. She's also written and produced stories for NPR, The New York Times, USA Today, The Miami Herald, and The Oxford American. And now she's author of The Allure of Immortality. Lynn Milner joins us today in the studio. Thank you for joining us on Gulf Coast Live.
It's great. Thanks, Jessica.
And you can join the conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. You can also send an email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org, comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or live tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. So, Lynn, who was Cyrus Teede?
Oh, gosh. He was an inscrutable man. He just... Well, he believed he was a messiah. He claims to have had an illumination in 1839 when he was 30 years old, when an angel appeared to him. And there's a lot of debate over whether he truly believed that that happened or whether that was a narrative that he published to market himself. So looking through his writing... It became clear to me that there was some part of him that did believe that. And so he set about trying to get followers. He was actually, who was he? Okay, he was a distant cousin of Joseph Smith's by marriage.
And Joseph Smith was?
Joseph Smith, the leader of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. So he worked on the Erie Canal when he was 11. You know, he had a really resonant speaking voice. People were just really attracted to him. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote about him that he was a magnetic man. So after he had his illumination, which was in New York, he set about trying to find followers and just failed spectacularly at that. But he got an invitation to Chicago. And he got to Chicago, and he was just one of those right place, right time moments where he preached in a lecture hall and people paid attention because of a lot of societal factors.
But also, he was a doctor, so he had some scientific facts that he added, right?
He did. Again, some of them were kind of inscrutable. He used words that he made up or that he sort of conjoined from different languages. And so people didn't quite understand, but some of them did. And he seemed to have the, you know, respectability and knowledge, and people started listening and following him. And so he got into a lot of trouble in Chicago and eventually came down to Estero, which is what led us here.
So we talk about – so the book's title includes the word immortality, and you're talking about his worshipers and why they followed him. What were some of the Koreshan beliefs?
Yeah. One of his promises was that that his people would live forever on Earth, that they would achieve immortality on Earth.
How would they do that?
By staying celibate. If they directed all of their sexual energy toward him And when I say sexual energy toward him, what I mean is they would convert it into a fondness for him. And it's hard to explain, but when it came time for him to become a deity, he would his pineal gland would explode and melt, and that would allow him to flow into the divine motherhood of his partner, Victoria Grazia. I sound like I'm crazy, and you're sort of – if you could see her, she's looking at me like I'm crazy, but this is what it was. And then he would flow into her and become a Bayoun god with her, and then his followers would follow suit, and they would all become Bayoun gods.
So Cyrus Teed is also known as Koresh, was notorious for recruiting wives, women who were already settled, married with children, and husbands often said their wives were weak and being manipulated by Teed. But you suggest a different perspective in the book. Why do you think these women in the late 1800s and early 1900s were interested in following Teed?
It was not an easy time to be a woman, especially in a large city in the 1890s, and divorce was a really tough thing to do. You not only lost your finances, you could lose your children. It wasn't easy to get a job. In Chicago, you know, women came to Chicago every day and disappeared. Shop girls just disappeared off the face of the earth. It was a dangerous place to be. Jack the Ripper was, you know, that was happening in London. So leaving your husband, who might not have been such a nice guy, going to a place that was safe, where you were with other women, where you could share labor, where you could share childcare, where you could have time for leisure, didn't seem like such a great, you know, a bad idea.
And you begin the book with the death of Cyrus Teed. His rotting corpse is in a bathtub, and his worshippers wait and watch for a few days as it decomposes because they believe he will be reborn, right? So then at the end of the book, you say when you came across the picture of his corpse, it was when you finally understood just how much the Koreshans believed in Teed. Is that why you start the book with this scene, to have the readers take the Koreshans seriously?
Maybe so. I mean, certainly a dramatic way to start the book. I think there was some resonance in starting in a way that helped, where I realized in the process where they really believed. I knew they believed in him. That was obvious. But just the fact that they were there waiting with his dead body, that it was real. It wasn't some myth that we've heard about the Koreshans for ages. You know, it was real. They took pictures of his body. And so when I saw that picture, I felt my first reaction was just like, oh, wow, yuck. And then my second reaction was just this really visceral, like, whoa, they really, really believed. I mean, they really believed.
And so the Koreshan family really started in Chicago, but they eventually get pushed out by the media and angry locals. How did they end up in Southwest Florida in Estero?
There was this guy who had settled the land that we now know as the Koreshan State Historic Site, and he wrote to them because he was suffering all kinds of hardships, and he offered them the land for a price. They came down on another mission but ran into him, and he ultimately nearly gave it to them for a very small sum of money. And so certainly the price was right. The settler had done a good job of choosing the land. It was on a river near the only trail that ran from Fort Myers to Naples. So it was going to be a really well located place. They could fish. They could grow their own food. They didn't have heating bills like they did in Chicago. There was no rent. For a while, the media wasn't dogging them, though that changed soon enough. And so Estero just seemed like a really good place to be. And like I say, the price was certainly right.
And so you mentioned the historic site. So how does the story of the Koreshans end? What's on the Estero property right now?
Well, it's a historic site. It's a park open to the public. It's a wonderful place. A lot of people actually believe that it has magical qualities. It's not unusual to hear people say that it's enchanted. And when you sit on Bamboo Landing and look out at the river, you kind of get a sense of that. And there is this deep feeling that there's a real history here. You know, people came here. They lived. They suffered. They believed outlandish things, but they bonded together and they built something, you know. And And that land is just incredibly special.
Let's talk a little bit about what they built. They created a few things there. They had schools, and they had a furniture company, and they grew all kinds of vegetables and food and sugar. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, they even had a tennis court. They had a drama troupe, an orchestra, a band. They had a grocery store. You know, again, at the crossing of the river and what's now 41, they had a grocery store. That was big business for them. They had a bakery. They had a sawmill. They built boats. They had concrete making, very advanced concrete manufacturing business. They were not only self-sufficient, but they provided goods to the larger community. So people needed them, and that worked to their advantage. They shipped citrus down the river, too.
You say early on in your book that this was one of the most important movements in America. Why is that?
Oh, wow. I think I was referring to the overall movement toward utopias. It's a time that we can't ever go back to because there came – during industrialization, there came this time when it wasn't possible to isolate anymore if you wanted to reform. And social reform increasingly happened within society. So it's this kind of quaint time when people believed that they could band together, be isolated, and also engage in social reform. And we don't have that anymore.
Throughout your book, you list similar communal groups of that time, like the Shakers and the Economites. Am I pronouncing that right? Mm-hmm. And even ones after its time, like the Charles Manson family. How do they relate? Why do you mention those?
Oh, gosh. I wanted to put him in context. I wanted to put Teed in context. Certainly, he was no Charles Manson, you know. And I think there is a temptation to sort of lump all cults or utopian societies into one group, and that's just impossible. They're all so individual. They might have similar aims or goals, but it was just really important for me to not just tell the story of Cyrus Teed and the Koreshans, but to put them in a larger context, like who really was this guy? What did they believe? How did it compare to the, you know, other organizations?
If you have any questions or comments for author Lynn Milner about her book, Profiling the Koreshans, give us a call at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Throughout your book, you seamlessly weave in information from Koreshans firsthand, like letters and memoirs, and then also information from the media of that time, the local newspapers. Why do you choose to present the information in this way?
I felt like it needed to be a story. So that was the biggest part of my research, is how to kind of meld those together. And I have elaborate Excel spreadsheets of what happened when and where I got the information. And for instance, I have a death threat letter. He received several death threats, but I was able to kind of put that in a timeline so I know where it needs to go. And then I was able to cross-reference journal entries with newspaper stories so that you would have a newspaper story appear. And this was in a time of yellow journalism. So one of my jobs was, how much can we trust what this journalist is saying, you know? But then I could cross-reference it with Koreshan letters, which told you exactly what the journalist got right and what the journalist said that was just ridiculous. So it was really important to me. In order to give the whole picture, I needed sights and sounds and smells and journals and diaries and maps and lawsuits and all of that stuff. And I needed to bring it together into a cogent storyline that people would want to read.
How do you think the media affected the way that the public viewed Koreshans?
Oh, it was everything. I mean, that's how, and even today, I mean, that's how we, once we're out of college, the main way we get our information is through the news. It's kind of a continuing ed, kind of free continuing ed for us. And so the only way that people learned about the Koreshans really was through the media, because they certainly didn't go up and knock on the door and say, hey, what are you guys all about? It was more convenient for them to just sort of other them and say, well, aren't they kooky? You know, aren't they weird? And so nobody really went in and asked who they really were. It was more the journalists reporting to them. So that's really their face. And Teed, you know, that was a challenge for him, because he certainly had a lot of publications. He wanted to get the word out about who they were, but he didn't write in a very accessible way, whereas you have these yellow journalists who were just writing these sensational stories that everybody just is drinking in, you know, and wanting to believe, even as they know that maybe it's not quite true.
Like what? What kinds of things do they talk about, Teed, that may not be quite true?
Well, you know, scantily clad women walking around inside the house. The fact that Teed was doing inappropriate things with husbands, wives, and maybe he was. I don't know. You know, we'll never know for sure. So there were all sorts of reports of inappropriate things going on that may or may not have been true. And getting to the bottom of that was really interesting and sometimes really frustrating.
So we have a question from Peggy in Estero. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Peggy. What's your question?
Hi. I was fortunate to work with Lynn and Melissa Vandenberg on the collection exhibit at FGCU this past spring. And as we were sifting through the collection books, Melissa discovered Teed's Bible. And you can imagine all of our excitement as we were holding the Bible of a self-proclaimed prophet. And then Lynn came in to see the Bible, and she discovered something about the Bible that we completely missed. And I wanted her to talk about that because it brought the Bible to life and really tied in the history of the Koreshans all the way back to Chicago just by holding this Bible. So I'd like Lynn to talk about that, and I'd like to ask Lynn how she knew to pick up that Bible and smell it.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your comment, Peggy. We'll talk about that right now. Thanks.
Peg, thanks so much for your question. And listeners should know that's Peg Phillips. She's with the College of Life Foundation. And after I had turned in the book, I was almost done with it. The College of Life Foundation gifted to FGCU's Special Archives, they gifted lots of wonderful items. And among those was this Bible, which turned out to be an incredible gift. And you know, if you read the book, you'll see why. But when Teed made his breakout speech in Chicago that I told you about, when he was in that lecture hall, he was lecturing in a place where in the basement there was a candy factory. And so I saw this in a little line in a newspaper story that was really hard to read, and I just was determined to make out what it was saying. But it mentioned that candy was being made in the basement of this lecture hall that had been a church. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. How could I find that out? What kind of candy? Because when you write a scene, you can't just say people smelled candy. That's not enough. You need to say what they smelled. Was it almond? Was it caramel? Was it vanilla nougat? What was it? So I went on this. It's probably too much to go into. I know we have to end at 1:30. But I went on this search that led me to know what kind of candy it was. And I talked with a friend who told me what candy smells would travel. You know, so I knew I found out what the confectionery was, what the name of the confectionery was. I found an ad saying what they sold. And then I emailed a friend and I said, okay, so which of these smells would travel? And she said, well, it's vanilla, rose cream, caramel, and almond. And I thought, well, that's really cool. Okay, so I wrote the scene. And I said, okay, as people sat in the pews listening to Cyrus Teed talk, they smelled these tantalizing smells of vanilla, rose cream, caramel, almond, right? So I wrote that scene. I had written most of the book. I turned it in. We still had an edit to do. And about that time is when the College of Life gifted these materials to the archives at FGCU. And I came in and I met Melissa Vandenberg, and she was going through. And she said, look at this Bible. Isn't it amazing? And I looked at it, and she wouldn't let me touch anything because it hadn't been processed. And this is a joke that Melissa and I tell. So I couldn't touch it. And I said, turn to the copyright page now. And she said, okay. And it was copyrighted a year before that breakout speech. And as she opened it, I just smelled something. And she smelled it too. And she said, man, I've never, she's worked with a lot of old books. And she said, never smelled a smell quite like this. What is that? And I bent over the book and I took a big whiff and I said, well, that's caramel, rose cream, almond, and vanilla. And she looked at me and she said, you're right. How do you know that? And I told her the story. And it's just, I think I answered Peg's question. That was a moment that you just don't get unless you are committed, really committed to knowing, you know, as much about the story that you can get. And it was just a huge gift, to a profound gift to get after doing that writing.
Why were you so intent on knowing what the smells were? Why was that important for the story you were telling? Before you even got to discovering the Bible, you were already looking into the smells. Why is that?
Yeah, because it was a big moment in the book, you know, and I'm formally trained in writing narrative journalism, creative nonfiction. And so one thing you learn in writing school is that when there's a big scene, you have to really blow it out, you know, and smell is a really good way to put people in place. I mean, I'm sure you've had the experience where you smell something and it takes you right back to a place where you were at a very specific time. So I wanted to get that smell right. And when I saw that there was candy, I thought, that's a lead I can follow up on. Maybe I can get the exact smell and put us in the church on that day when Cyrus Teed took off.
Do you think the smells of candy helped his recruitment in any way?
I don't know. You know, it's nice to think that they did. I know I would have been distracted as all get out by smelling candy. And of course, that's what the yellow journalist suggested in his article. But, you know, you can't help but think that maybe some people were drawn to the, you know, sweetness of the moment.
And you mentioned in your book that your husband considered himself one of the men whose wives was taken by Cyrus Teed. Why did he feel that way?
I just didn't see him very often when I was writing the book. He would, you know, he would bring me lunch while I was writing, and then we would, you know, get together for dinner. But I just wrote all the time, and I was also just obsessed with Cyrus Teed, and so he said that. He knew that Cyrus Teed had, as one husband put it, made his hearthstone desolate. And so Jesse started saying that that had happened. And in fact, and I still feel bad about this, and Jesse, if you're listening, I'm sorry that I confused our wedding anniversary with Cyrus Teed's birthday more than once.
Let's talk a little bit more about you were immersed in this research. Talk a little bit about your research process. You said it took 5 years to write this book. You were also doing other work. This was, you know, was this kind of like a side project? And talk about your research.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in the summers, I was, you know, full bore research. And then when I was teaching, I would write or research, you know, first couple hours of the morning, and then I would go on do my life, you know, and teach. And it was a nice kind of balance. Research is, you know, you can get lost in archives and just, it just seems endless. And archives sound like boring, dusty places, but they're anything but. I remember being in Tallahassee, looking through the Koreshian archives, and I was seated across the table from a man who was looking through a different, you know, set of archives. And he started crying. And I don't know why. He was looking through slave records, so I could only imagine that it might be that he had found an ancestor, found out information about an ancestor who had been a slave. But he was just, he was weeping openly. And I know in my own research, I had moments where I wept, moments where I gasped, moments where I laughed out loud. And so the research, you know, even though it sounds kind of dry and dusty, it can be an incredibly fulfilling, rewarding experience. And so that's what my research was like, and it made me want to keep going and learning and discovering.
What was the most memorable moment when you were doing your research, when you had one of those moments where you gasped or?
Oh, man. Well, the dead body, seeing the picture of the dead body that I thought I would never see, talking to the medical examiner about what the followers must have been seeing, talking to a psychiatrist about what Teed's disorder might have been.
Which is what?
Well, back in Freud's day, and I read a book by a Freud biographer, Ernest Jones, who had written out all the symptoms of the God complex, what was then called the God complex, and Teed met every single. It was like a checklist for Teed's personality. And so I talked to a modern-day psychiatrist, and I said, you know, I don't hear the phrase, the God complex, you know, bandied about anymore. And he said, no, we don't use that term today. We would diagnose Teed with two things, narcissistic personality disorder and probably bipolar disorder.
Why did you want to tell this story?
I felt like, you know, it started as a magazine story. I was just going to write a 2,000-word story and go on to my next project because I was freelancing. And as I researched, it haunted me that these well-educated, cultured, well-off people would give up everything to follow a man to a mosquito-infested forest in Florida and try to build a city against so many challenges. And yet, when I read their letters and journals and looked at their photos, they didn't seem crazy to me. And so I just wanted to know why they would do it. And in 2,000 words in a magazine story, I couldn't get beyond that kind of, gee, aren't they goofy kind of sentiment. And so I just really felt strongly that they deserved their own book.
Has anybody written anything, do you think, like this book before in the research that you found?
There's some short pamphlets. There are a couple of short pamphlets about Cyrus Teed and the Koreshans. This is really the first definitive complete history that takes you through from his birth all the way through modern day.
And so after immersing yourself in Koreshan history and life, what is your takeaway?
Oh, gosh, just realizing that all of us, they believed we lived inside of a hollow earth. I don't believe that, though I do have several hollow earthers following me on Facebook now. But I think that we do live inside of echo chambers. And I'm a journalist and I study news literacy. I study a lot of news and how it's presented. And while, most of us don't walk around thinking we live in a hollow earth, we do believe, as the Koreshans did, that we like to believe that we live inside a knowable world. We don't, but we like to believe that. Our brains don't deal well with dissonance. And so we tend to sort of be drawn to news and information we agree with. And it's a struggle to open up and allow that dissonance and listen to opposing views. Otherwise, we form these thought tribes, which isn't so different from the Koreshans. So I took away from it, this urgency to resist putting yourself in that kind of echo chamber.
That's all the time we have for this segment of Gulf Coast Live. Thanks so much for joining us, Lynn.
Thanks so much.
Lynn Milner is author of The Allure of Immortality, An American Cult, A Florida Swamp, and A Renegade Prophet. It was published recently by the University Press of Florida. I'm Jessica Mazaros. It's time for a break. When we return, zombies will converge on downtown Fort Myers this weekend by the thousands for the 9th annual ZombieCon. We'll explore why the event continues to grow each year, along with a closer examination of the rich history and subtext of the zombie genre itself, and just what it is about zombies that keeps us fascinated. That conversation's just ahead. This is WGCU News, NPR for Southwest Florida. Stay with us.